Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In addition to the United States Constitution, every state has its own constitution, which serves as the supreme law of that particular state, outlines the structure of state government, the rights of its citizens, and the processes for legislation and judicial review. And while those constitutions share similarities with the U.S. Constitution, state constitutions often go into much greater detail and are amended more frequently. The first North Carolina Constitution was adopted in 1776, just after independence, with major revisions in 1868. The current version dates to 1971, but has been amended many times, and it turns out most North Carolinians have only a passing acquaintance with exactly what the document contains or how it affects their lives. A recent survey conducted by Catawba College and YouGov shows that a majority, 54%, have minimal to no familiarity with our state constitution. What's more, 55% favor allowing voter-led constitutional amendments that would bypass the legislature. Because so many know so little about this document, we thought we'd take a look at our state constitution, at what this Catawba College poll discovered, and at exactly what kind of impact this document has on each of us. Dr. Michael Bitzer is professor of politics and history and director of the Center for North Carolina Politics and Public Service at Catawba College. He's here along with Dr. Chris Cooper, director of the Hare Institute for Public Policy at Western Carolina University and author of Anatomy of a Purple State, a North Carolina Politics Primer. And Lucy Inman is a retired North Carolina Court of Appeals judge who previously served as a Superior Court judge. Now she's practicing law again in Raleigh and serving as a commercial arbitrator. Thank you all for being here. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So, Michael, before we talk about the Constitution, tell us why Catawba College and YouGov decided to conduct this survey about people's familiarity with that document.
Yeah, we were planning for our Constitution Day event, which is every year on September 17th. And we had, you know, a bunch of us had been talking about the familiarity of the U.S. Constitution, wanting to have a sense, do we all sing off the same page when it comes to the national governing document? But then we also talked about the fact that the state has a constitution. It has its own governing document, and wanted to explore some questions in about that particular constitution. So we put together this survey, went out into the field in August, and came up with not just these results on the state constitution, but also the national one. You mentioned the familiarity. 80% are familiar with the U.S. Constitution. Less than half are familiar with the state constitution. And I think that speaks
Volumes. I'll let you finish the sentence.
Yeah.
Judge Inman, since federal law takes precedence over state law, which is the more important document, the U.S. Constitution, to North Carolinians, the U.S. Constitution or our state constitution? And in terms of how it guides what decisions judges make?
Well, in terms of importance, like many things in the law, it depends. The United States Constitution governs every person in the United States and provides rights for every person in the United States. North Carolina Constitution includes allegiance to the United States Constitution. So if there is a conflict between the two and the state constitution would restrict a right that's guaranteed in the U.S. Constitution, the U.S. Constitution governs. The converse situation is if the United States Constitution does not recognize a right, is silent on a right, and the North Carolina Constitution provides for that right, then the North Carolina Constitution will govern that area. These are issues that usually are considered delegated for states' rights to begin with. But we're talking about, as the U.S. Supreme Court has said not long ago, free elections. Those issues are to be decided by the U.S. Constitution and the North Carolina Constitution. And if the North Carolina Constitution provides greater rights and protections, we go with that. On the other hand, when people talk about the Second Amendment, and the United States Supreme Court in recent years has expanded the application of the Second Amendment to allow citizens to carry guns outside of their homes. North Carolina has a corollary to the Second Amendment. I have never heard anyone say that it would not allow that, but even if it didn't, it would be trumped by the federal constitution.
So when you got the results of this survey back, Michael, one of the things you found is that North Carolinians have both a, quote, striking knowledge gap about our Constitution and a strong bipartisan consensus on key governance issues. Are you saying that citizens hold very familiar feelings on how state government should operate and what it should do, while at the same time have very little knowledge of how those actions might be governed by our state constitution? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, pretty much so. I mean, I think the details of the state constitution, just are not top of mind, but a lot of the basic principles, separation of powers, you know, those kinds of issues tend to resonate across the board and across the political spectrum. So what we found in this survey was really, you know, a lot of people in North Carolina have a lot of similar ideas and values and concepts when it comes to some basic constitutional principles. Maybe they don't know the specifics within the state constitution, but they believe in some fundamental values and guidelines.
So, Chris Cooper, as a fellow political scientist, which surprises you more, the lack of knowledge that citizens have about our state constitution or this bipartisan consensus? My gosh, that can't happen on key issues in a highly divided time.
You know, neither one is particularly surprising, which is not the same as saying they're not important things to study, right? So we spent a lot of time talking about the U.S. Constitution. There's big best-selling books that come out about the U.S. Constitution. But most North Carolinians, most people who live, you know, most South Carolinians, most Virginians, most Oklahomans, if that's a word, probably don't know much at all about their state constitutions. I think Michael's survey shows that well. I think it's also probably even a slightly rosy picture, right? Because what Michael asks them is, you know, a self-assessment of how knowledgeable you are, how much you're aware of it. And even then, right, people are willing to say, not really that aware. My guess is they probably even plan that up a little. So I think knowledge and awareness is probably actually lower even than Michael's survey shows. But then the bipartisan consensus, I guess maybe that is really the surprising piece here, right? I mean, even things that we think of as very controversial, like whether voter ID should be included in the state constitution. Yeah, there were partisan divisions, like Republicans like voter ID more than Democrats, but the plurality of people that Michael surveyed still said, yeah, we kind of dig this voter ID thing, right? It kind of, you know, term limits, something else pretty controversial. We saw differences across parties, but still the plurality of people came together. So in some ways it's a, you know, it is both a glass half full and a glass half empty results, I think, that Michael's able to provide here. And I think it's a real service to the state just to cast our eye for a little bit to the state constitution that is, as Justice Edmund said, incredibly important, but we just don't know that much about.
I want to ask you just, Judge Edmund, how this plays out in the court. I'm assuming that all the lawyers who go before a judge in the court are familiar with the state constitution. Perhaps the plaintiffs are not. Does that play any role whatsoever in how in what happens in a courtroom?
Well, sure. And, you know, I would really say until about 30 years ago, I don't know how many North Carolina lawyers turned to the state constitution. I clerked at the North Carolina Supreme Court under then Chief Justice Exum, who, along with Justice Martin, was a big advocate of turning to the state constitution And now I think more lawyers look to the state constitution when it's applicable. It's not going to be applicable to your average business dispute. But if you're having a dispute with the state of North Carolina, it may very well apply. We have some unique rights under the North Carolina state constitution that other states don't have.
Well, I was going to ask about that because you already mentioned that there are certain rights that are spelled out in the U.S. Constitution that can't be taken away by the state constitution, but the Constitution in North Carolina does add some rights that are not specifically mentioned in the U.S. Constitution. Does our state constitution give us more freedoms, more rights than perhaps people in other states because of that document?
It does. And the North Carolina Supreme Court, which is the ultimate authority on the North Carolina state constitution, has held that in recent years. One example is the first section of the first article of the North Carolina state constitution, which is the Declaration of Rights. And it provides for life, liberty, fruits of one, the right to receive the fruits of one's labor, and the pursuit of happiness and equality. Well, we all know life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, right, from the Declaration of Independence. But the right to receive the fruits of one's labor was added to the North Carolina Constitution in 1868. And historians and legal scholars believe that it was added directly in response to the end of the Civil War and the beginning of Reconstruction, to provide that formerly enslaved people not only couldn't be slaves, but could not be forced to work for no pay. And that's an example of something that came about in history, but has been applied in North Carolina to protect businesses from what's considered arbitrary or unreasonable government interference, and to protect public employees from arbitrary treatment.
This survey that we're talking about, Michael, that Catawba College conducted is actually two surveys. I think one in June and one in August. And one was focused on the state constitution. The other kind of took a look at our familiarity with the United States Constitution. And you have said that the survey shows a significant gap in civic education when it comes to the state's governing document and principles. Does that gap extend to people's understanding and knowledge of the U.S. Constitution? And in either case, where do you put the blame for that lack of civic education?
So most Americans would have, a passing understanding, I think, of the U.S. Constitution and the principles, that we have three branches of government. Now, when you get into the specifics, how many members of the U.S. Supreme Court are there? People just, unless you're diehard politics geeks, you're not going to know those kinds of numbers and facts. But what we were really trying to understand with both surveys is, we talk so much about the political division that, there are so many differences among Americans. Are the differences evident when it comes to some fundamental principles of American governance? And oftentimes that is through constitutionalism. And what we found is no, there is a lot of bipartisan agreement on some fundamental principles within our constitutions, both state and national. So I think that that's the point of both surveys.
You might also know these geeky principles if you were an immigrant trying to become a citizen, because they have to take a test and they generally end up knowing more than people who are natively born here. Speaking of geeks, our politics geeks, Michael Bitzer and Chris Cooper, will be back on the other side along with Judge Lucy Inman. We're taking a break. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Constitution, the North Carolina State Constitution, and our knowledge or lack of knowledge of it as was discovered by a recent survey taken by Catawba College and YouGov. Catawba College's information comes from Dr. Michael Bitzer, who is professor of politics and history there and director of the North Carolina Politics and Public Service Center at Catawba College. Dr. Chris Cooper, also with us, political scientist, director of the Hare Institute for Public Policy at Western North Carolina, and Judge Lucy Inman, formerly with the North Carolina Court of Appeals and now practicing law in Raleigh. So I asked before the break, because the survey finds a significant gap in civic education, where you would place the blame for that gap, Michael, and you didn't have a chance because we ran out of time to answer that second half. Where do you put the blame?
I spread the blame across the board. I think, you know, certainly K through 12 and the really decrease in what we see in civic education, basic understanding of American government, is a core component. But I refer back to the beginning of the U.S. Constitution, and I believe also to our state constitution, we the people. If we are going to have this kind of operating governing system of a democratic republic, it is incumbent upon us to be invested and to understand the dynamics of our governing systems, both nationally, at the state level, even at the local level. And I think that, you know, we hear a lot about people fighting over politics, but oftentimes people don't understand the basic mechanisms. And I think it's incumbent, if we're going to have this kind of governing system, we got to get ourselves involved just as much as the politicians and elected officials do.
And I often wonder if that's deliberate. And yet, Judge Inman, the right to a good education is spelled out in the state constitution, something that we know is underfunded, and there's a court case pending. It's been pending for 20 years on whether or not the state should fully fund education to guarantee that right. But talk about that. I mean, if we fully funded it, do we actually follow through on that constitutional principle that every child deserves a complete, thorough education?
North Carolina's constitution provides the most express and the strongest right to public education. It was amended in 1868 and again later to emphasize that every student has a right to a sound basic education in free public schools. It's my understanding that we have unanimous agreement on the North Carolina Supreme Court that is a fundamental right. There's no disagreement about that. But there's a disagreement about how the state can be compelled to provide the funds to make that possible. And that is an issue of separation of powers, in which advocates to fund what was known as the Leandro case would say, how can you possibly say this is a fundamental right if you're not going to make it possible? And opponents of that argument say this is an issue for the legislature to decide, and not even the North Carolina Supreme Court can order the legislature to appropriate specific funds.
And this, Christopher, is where we get to separation of powers. And this survey that Catawba College conducted, with a margin of error of about 3.83% either side, finds that most people believe our three state branches of government hold equal power. And it's interesting that people feel that way at a time when, at the federal level at least, this unitary executive theory is being exercised by the White House, because they want all of the power and all of the control, and they're getting little to no pushback from the other branches of the federal government. They too are supposed to have three equal branches of government. And some would say federally that the Congress is the most important branch, because it's mentioned in Article 1. The executive branch comes along later in the Constitution. So how are state powers laid out in our state constitution, Chris?
Yeah, it's really not all that equal. Essentially, our state constitution passed, you know, again, took the third We've had three different state constitutions, as Judge Edmund said before, 1971, we get the last one. And throughout all three of these state constitutions, it's really laid out a legislature first state. States vary dramatically in the power in which the legislature and the governor has, in which they can exercise. And so our governor has long been an extremely weak governor. Folks can argue for a while about whether it was the 48th or 49th most powerful governor in the country. The bottom line was not very powerful at all. We were the last state in the country to give our governor the veto power. And when we did, we made it the weakest veto power humanly possible. And since
that was in the 90s.
That was absolutely in the 90s. Yeah. And of course, the great irony of North Carolina politics is that we have this veto power. When I say, why is it weak? Because the governor doesn't have veto power over redistricting, over local bills, and over constitutional amendments. So just stop for a second and think, how different would our state be? How much less money would we have spent on litigation, for example, if the governor could veto these redistricting maps? And the grand irony, of course, of North Carolina politics is the primary sponsor of that weak veto bill was a Nash County state senator named Roy Cooper, who later on, I'm sure, wishes he had made that veto power just a little bit more powerful. So it's really not three co-equal branches. It is a legislature first state. And even in the last few years, the legislature has chipped away at gubernatorial power even more, right? So we start with the weakest, maybe 48th or 49th most powerful governor in the country. He's now, without question, the 50th, the least powerful governor in the United States, and frankly, getting less powerful by the day. That is not a dig or a compliment to Josh Stein. That is a fact of the institution more so than it is the person.
So let's go back to the beginnings. Is it constitutionally a weak governor? Was it designed that way? And if so, why? Our first constitution was in 1776. Was it that way in that first constitution in response to not wanting a tyrant to run North Carolina?
Yeah, not surprisingly, you're right as usual, Mike. So that was correct. That we didn't want a tyrant. We wanted weak executive power. When we had our Reconstruction Constitution, as it's referred to after the Civil War, a very, very weak governor. And cutting forward to 1970, when we bring it up for a vote to the people and then enacted in 1971, an incredibly weak governor. So this has been a feature of North Carolina, you know, since the founding, quite literally.
Michael.
And one of the questions we asked was about this very issue, and we framed it as North Carolina elects the largest number of executive officers. I mean, we elect the governor, lieutenant governor, auditor down to treasurer. And that diffuses and spreads out executive power and authority from the governor to other officials that he has no control over. So we ask the question, you know, in some states, when the governor is elected, the governor appoints all of the executive officers. They report to the governor. Would you support or oppose changing the North Carolina system to allow only the governor to be elected and appoint all the other executive officers? Overwhelmingly, a majority were opposed to doing that. Only 3 out of 10 said, yes, I want a governor who can appoint. So we're still very much in that mentality of, we don't like concentrated executive power, so we're going to diffuse it across the board.
Wow. Lessons to be learned at the federal level. So, I want to go through some of the responses with regard to this aspect of our Constitution, because responses to this poll, if I read it correctly, Michael, indicate that close to a majority of citizens believe that our government is balanced with these three equal branches of government. But among those who see or believe that there is one dominant branch, I think 19% or a quarter see the legislature as dominant, 19% see the governor as dominant, and 9% point to the courts as holding the most power. What do you take from that?
Well, I think for those folks that do understand the basic dynamics of state government and how power is distributed, it kind of falls into line with what we would normally think. I mean, nothing against our brethren on the benches or sisters on the benches. But, you know, courts have typically been seen as the weakest of the three branches of government, in this state at least, because the legislature is so dominant in terms of that. So these, you know, for folks who could identify which branch was seen as the more powerful one, this doesn't surprise me. It kind of falls into line typically with what we think about with that power distribution.
But is it true, Judge Inman, the legislature may pass the laws, the governor may sign or veto those laws and run the day-to-day operations of the government, allegedly, but the judicial system passes judgment on the legality and the application of these laws that the legislature has passed and has been signed into law? Does that give the court the ultimate authority, give them the most power in reality?
Holistically, I wouldn't say the most power. You know, the legislature has the power of the purse. The governor, the executive, has the power of the sword. The judiciary really has the power of what's provided in the United States and the state constitution and in the people's confidence that the justices on our Supreme Court are honestly and in nonpartisan fashion interpreting that document. The courts have the ultimate authority to say what the law is. Now, you've seen many constitutional amendments in the last couple of decades. And that's because, in part, if the North Carolina Supreme Court rules that a statute is unconstitutional, the North Carolina Supreme Court can't do anything about the legislature amending the statute or even more, proposing a constitutional amendment. Once a constitutional amendment has been approved by the voters, now the North Carolina Constitution is different than what it used to be. And so the legislature has tremendous power in literally not interpreting the law, but changing what the state constitution says.
I want to come back in a second to something you just talked about, and that is the public's confidence in believing that the courts have a nonpartisan view of interpreting the law, because that increasingly has come into question, not just here, but at the United States level. We'll come back to that in a second. Speaking of amendments, your survey asked people, Michael, about how we amend our Constitution. The current Constitution was put into place in 1971. It has been amended 40 times since 1971, which sounds like a lot to me. And one of the amendments, which was ratified just a few years ago in 1996, as we've just talked about, gave the governor veto power over legislation, which just shows you how powerful the legislative branch is. And the fact that we've had so many amendments, 40 amendments in 54 years, sounds remarkable. Is it?
It is, and I think it also reflects the changing dynamics and what North Carolinians want in their superior governing document. I think that this gives the flexibility of having, you know, things adapted, times change, different interpretations may come about different provisions or different ideas. In terms particularly of public policy. Here I'm thinking about the victims' rights component to our state constitution. That was enshrined. That becomes the highest law of the state. And so the flexibility, the ability to change the document certainly is something that's notable, but it gives us this kind of release valve to be able to put into the highest constitutional law of the land what we want in today's society.
The U.S. Constitution, Chris, has been in place in 1791, and there have only been 27 amendments to that Constitution, which means it must be very difficult to amend the United States Constitution. What's the process in North Carolina? How easy or difficult is it?
Sure. I think this is one of the things about the North Carolina State Constitution is we, the people, in this way, don't really have any right to be able to do this. So in some states, and Michael actually asked a question about this on a survey. So in some states, we could get together, we could start a petition, we could get a constitutional amendment put on the ballot. In North Carolina, we do not have that option. It's yet another example of where the power, the primary power in our state comes from the General Assembly. They are the ones who decide to put it on the ballot, and then it goes to a vote of the people. And not surprisingly, the vast majority of the time when amendments come up in North Carolina, they pass because the General Assembly are not full of a bunch of political knuckleheads, right? These are people who know if they put something on the ballot, it is likely to pass. So the vast, vast, vast majority of the time when they get there, they know they're going to be popular. And this runs from things that fundamentally affect our daily lives to things like the constitutional right to hunt and fish, which was brought up a couple of years ago and passed. Now, maybe that does fundamentally affect your daily life, but I don't know that it would be as important as some of the other amendments that have come up in recent years.
Sometimes surveys show diametrically opposed opinions being held by the same people at the same time. And Michael, this may be one area. Your survey indicates that 7 out of 10, 70% of North Carolinians support sticking with the state's current two-stage constitutional amendment process, which involves the legislature and then the vote of the citizenry. And at the same time, 55% believe that we should have voter-led constitutional amendment process that would bypass the legislature entirely. That sounds like a contradiction, is it?
It is and it isn't. I mean, you can have multiple ways of amending a constitution. Certainly, we think of the federal constitution as Congress, both chambers passing an amendment, and then it goes to ratification of the states. Actually, there are four different methods by which to change the U.S. Constitution. So certainly there can be variations, there can be different venues, avenues by which to change this governing document. But certainly it seems like a majority of North Carolinians believe their voice is just as important as the General Assembly's voice in putting together these constitutional amendments.
And Chris, I have 30 seconds left. If we went to this, some states do have the citizen's right to amend the Constitution. If we went to that, what would change?
Presumably a lot, right? I mean, I imagine we would see, for example, gerrymandering reform, which Michael talks about in his survey that he asked questions about, things that are very, very popular that the General Assembly may not want for a variety of reasons.
And we're going to talk about gerrymandering and photo ID and term limits, all things being suggested by possible amendments when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcharlotteregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the state constitution, what it does, what it says, how it affects you, how you amend it, with Dr. Michael Bitzer, whose Catawba College organization put together a survey of a little over 1,000 North Carolinians to test their knowledge of both the U.S. and the state constitution. He's here along with Dr. Chris Cooper from Western Carolina University and Judge Lucy Inman, former Superior Court judge and a retired member of the North Carolina Court of Appeals. So there are some constitutional amendments that are rummaging around in the dark, waiting for something to happen with them. And one of them is a new amendment proposed for the November 26 election cycle that would require photo ID when voting by mail. According to your survey, Michael, that amendment is supported by 2/3 of North Carolinians. But I'm wondering how you do that. How do you present a photo ID when voting by mail?
Well, you'd have to make a copy of something. We've seen that in the past.
I could make a copy of your picture and send it in with my ballot.
Sure, but the name on the photo identification would be Michael Bitzer as opposed to Michael Collins. So, this is what the issue becomes when people decide to put this kind of policy decision making before the public, this is going to be incumbent upon us as North Carolinians to understand the ramifications, the impacts, the benefits, the costs to these kinds of public policy decisions. And certainly voting by mail, North Carolinians do it. It's a small percentage, but they use that particular vote method. And the question becomes, are you getting the right ballot from the right voter? All of these kind of issues need to be debated and discussed before voters go to it.
And let's remember, other than the Uecava voters, the federal voters, we already had that in place as the law of the land last cycle. So I voted by mail, for example. And when I did, I made a copy of my photo ID. I stuck it in the envelope. I sent it to the Jackson County Board of Elections, and they processed it that way. So this is one that would change for these federal folks, the folks who are stationed overseas, these so-called Uecava voters. But for the for domestic voters in North Carolina, this is not enshrined in the Constitution, but it is already the law of the state.
So let's live overseas. It is really, really difficult. You wouldn't think so, but it's really a barrier to go through all the red tape in a foreign country to get a photo ID. I think that if people have a running start and are starting now to try to get that photo ID before the Constitution is amended, they'll have a chance. But many, many of our armed service members and their families have great difficulty producing what might not seem difficult to do for residents of North Carolina.
80%, Christopher, of the respondents to this survey favor a constitutional amendment imposing term limits on state legislators. Only 8% oppose that. But given the way our Constitution is amended, legislature first, is this ever likely to happen?
Can I just say no and we move on to the next question? No, I want to get to you. I don't want to be that glib. Look, there is almost no chance that this moves forward. The General Assembly, the legislature, is not going to do things that are going to hurt themselves. What we see is Democrats, Republicans, federally, at the state level, all of it, they all campaign on term limits. They all say it's a great idea until they've been in for a couple of cycles and think that they've finally learned the way these things work. And look, the term limits argument is an interesting one, and it's a one where the political science research, generally speaking, kind of runs counter to public opinion. So there's some real cost to term limits. For example, if you were to put in term limits in North Carolina, like a lot of states have done, three citizen initiatives, what happens is you term limit these folks out, and what do? They become lobbyists. So essentially, you're handing the keys to the state, not from the legislators who you can at least theoretically hold responsible, but you're handing that key directly to lobbyists who we have no ability to elect or to vote out of office. So you're empowering these unelected officials to really be the ones who hold the keys to the state.
And here's something I want to ask Judge Inman about, because the courts in North Carolina have spent a significant amount of time in the last many years talking about gerrymandering. And majorities of North Carolinians, evidently according to this survey, support measures to ban partisan gerrymandering when redistricting. We have seen these major battles over gerrymandering in the state, winding their way through state and federal courts. The federal courts have said that while racial gerrymandering is illegal, unconstitutional, political gerrymandering is not. Can you explain why a court would come to that conclusion, make that distinction? Can you explain why the process of drawing districts in any way that is less than accurately representative would be legal under either our state or federal constitutions?
Well, Michael, I'll try. And I will say the reason that they should be equal is very well explained in a decision by the North Carolina Supreme Court in December of 2020, which held that indeed partisan gerrymandering violates the North Carolina Constitution. A month later or 2 months later, when the composition of the North Carolina Supreme Court changed, that decision was called back for reconsideration. And the new court held that it didn't. The ironic thing about that is the cases that the U.S. Supreme Court has considered in deciding whether racial gerrymandering versus partisan gerrymandering should be treated differently. The U.S. Supreme Court has said it doesn't find that the partisan demographic, the identity as a partisan, is not a protected class like race, and therefore under the U.S. Constitution, it's not unlawful. But in that decision, I think that was Rucho v. I can't remember.
Common Cause.
Rucho v. Common Cause. Chief Justice Roberts wrote that, don't worry, we're not just saying take a hike on your concerns about partisan gerrymandering, because this is a decision best made by the states. This is a decision best made by the states. And then in Harper v. Hall, it came up again, and there were all sorts of novel theories about why partisan gerrymandering should not be considered unlawful. And it came back to North Carolina Supreme Court. And because of that later decision by our North Carolina Supreme Court, other states' Supreme Courts can decide whether or not partisan gerrymandering is unconstitutional under their constitution. In North Carolina, it's going to take overturning the decision that says it's not unconstitutional.
So let's talk about this, because as you pointed out, one version of our North Carolina Supreme Court outlawed it. An election was held. The political complexion of the Supreme Court changed. They reheard the case or redecided the case and took the opposite point of view, which feeds into this idea that the courts are becoming increasingly political. We didn't used to elect judges with a D or an R behind their names. Now we do. We just went through this whole thing with one of the justices on the state Supreme Court fighting it out with a candidate who wanted to be on the state Supreme Court. And it really kind of came down to the makeup of the courts. That's what it looked like it was going to come down to as to who was going to get this. So two questions. Should judges be elected, given that most voters know nothing about them or what they do? And should these races be partisan? You're the judge.
So first, remember, Michael talked about voters don't want the governor to appoint other members of the executive branch. Mm-hmm. Voters really hold on to their right to vote. And people are not inclined to give up their right to elect judges, even if they don't know anything about them. In my strong view, partisan judicial elections are undermining the very safeguards and purposes of our judiciary. In North Carolina, the legislature passed a law that you can't be on the ballot for judge unless you are registered Democrat or Republican or file a petition, which takes a whole lot of work to get on the ballot. Once a candidate has to identify as a Democrat or Republican, well, of course they're folded in to that partisan infrastructure. The whole party is members of their party expect them to toe the party line. But that's not the job of the judge. The judge's job is to find what the law provides without fear or favor. I was elected in a nonpartisan election in 2014, and I enjoyed the support of many Republicans and Democrats because it pushed me to the middle.
If the party expects a judge to toe the party line and the judge knows that's not their job, why are they acting or seemingly acting that way? Not just here, but at the U.S. Supreme Court. They take an oath to the Constitution. They don't take an oath to the Republican or Democratic parties.
You're exactly right about that. And I think this is one of the public, this is one of the perceptions that gives the public so little confidence in the integrity of our court system. The way that a judge is supposed to decide cases is with intellectual honesty, following all sorts of rules of interpreting statutes and the Constitution and following precedent. I think particularly when courts overturn longstanding precedent, that invites public criticism that you have, the makeup of this court has changed, you have changed the law that everyone has relied on. It's a very deep concern.
Getting back to gerrymandering, which is a conversation being held everywhere in the country right now as Republican-controlled states try to gerrymander between the censuses, if that's the right word, censi, to make sure that 2026 turns out well for Republicans. 54%, according to your survey, Michael, 54% of people responding favor an independent redistricting commission be established, where the General Assembly would establish a process for this, but have no role in drawing the districts. Other states have gone in that direction, even with the will of the people clearly behind this change. Does this have a ghost of a chance of ever happening here?
I would say, again, I would echo my distinguished colleague, no, in the short answer. I think what you're seeing in a state like California is they indeed went this particular route. They had the voters approve it. And now, because of what Texas did, California is saying, you know what, we're going to set that independent redistricting commission maps aside for a couple of years.
No, they're asking the voters whether they will let them.
They're asking the voters, yes. Okay. But the voters are just as partisan as you know, other dynamics. So, you know, the common criticism you'll get is, define independent. You know, is independent nonpartisan? Is it bipartisan? Is it equal partisanship? You know, what is it? And, you know, we'll see how it all kind of plays out.
And Chris, we have a question from a listener. It says, our state constitution goes into greater detail on items like finance, local governance, etc., compared to the U.S. Constitution. Is this common in other state constitutions?
Yeah, I love, so whoever asked this, thank you. So yes, it is common in other state constitutions. What's really important in some ways, maybe other than the legislature first thing, the most important part, I think, in our state constitution is that our local governments do not have home rule power. I get that it sounds boring, but this is incredibly important. So in some states like Ohio, they essentially say municipalities, so cities, towns, villages, those kinds of things, can sort of do whatever they want as long as they don't infringe with state law. That is not the case in North Carolina. We are not a home rule state. What that means is that our municipalities, our towns, villages, cities have to go to the state legislature to ask permission to do much more than they do in many other states. And so if I can think about something like the fight over bathrooms in Charlotte, yes, substantively, that was obviously a battle over trans rights, however you want to look at that issue. But at the same time, it was a battle over vertical power and to what degree the city of Charlotte should be able to make a decision that the state legislature does not agree with. So for the listener who asked that question, yes, it's common to go into the kind of detail of the state government, but the way we do it in North Carolina fundamentally alters the sort of battles over power you see in our state.
It gives, again, more power to the legislature and less power to the local governments. I think we see this conflict coming in with sanctuary cities.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And if you have, and I know that a survey does not hold the weight of law, but when surveys come out that clearly indicate a preference by voters to go in a different direction than their government has decided they should go, what does that say about the nature of what we really have as a government? Is it truly representative, or is it people who have been ensconced in power and they're going to do what they want because they know what's right, Michael?
Sure. I mean, you know, that, you know, when public will expresses one way and the elected officials decide to either ignore it or go in a different direction, the consequence has to come from the public will.
I would encourage people to look at this survey. How do they get to it? How do they see it?
catawba.edu/NC Politics Center. We have all the surveys listed on that page.
And you can see where you fall in line with those who were asked and answered these questions. Dr. Michael Bitzer, Professor of Politics and History, Director of the Center for North Carolina Politics and Public Service at Catawba College. Dr. Chris Cooper, Professor of Political Science, Director of the Hare Institute for Public Policy at Western Carolina. And Judge Lucy Inman, formerly with the Court of Appeals and a former Superior Court judge. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.